Colleagues, we might get started. Welcome to the Charles Perkins Centre. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Andrew Wilson. I'm the co-director of the Menzies Centre for Health Policy at the University of Sydney here. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're gathered today for this meeting and acknowledge elders past and present in relation to that. It gives me great pleasure today to be able to introduce Professor Richard Sullivan. If I might just be allowed a minute introduction to that. Must be 6 months ago, suddenly, I don't know whether it was the middle of the night or one of those very early mornings, I suddenly started getting these text messages and then emails from Sanchia Arenda, who's the CEO of Cancer Council Australia, in great excitement about this presentation that she was hearing in Paris, I think it was. And I, you know, much as I love hearing from Sanchia, it was a little surprise to get these notes. And then, as I say, these emails started to appear with photos of the slides which were being presented. And indeed, it was Richard who was presenting at that cancer conference. And as I looked at these slides, I could see that it was absolutely fascinating work that he was presenting, and stuff that both of us agreed were things that we would love to hear, give people an opportunity in Australia to hear. And thank you very much to Cancer Council Australia in supporting Richard to come here and allowing us to co-sponsor this seminar with Richard on Can We Cure the Price Problem for New Cancer Technologies? So Richard is the Professor of Cancer and Global Health at King's College London and the founding director of the Institute of Cancer Policy and at the King's Conflict and Health Research Group. He's qualified in medicine, trained in surgery, in neurology, so you could make a few quick bucks while you're here, gaining his PhD from the University College London. He was clinical director of Cancer Research UK for nearly 10 years, has led programs for the UN, the OSCE and other organisations in global health and post-health reconstruction in many parts of the world. I won't go through the rest of the many things that he's been involved with, but just to say that the overlapping issues between the issues of affordable cancer therapy as we see them in Australia as a major issue, you know, for example, some of you know I'm the chair of the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee. One drug alone that we will consider next week will cost in the order of $600 million for a relatively small group of patients if we approve that particular drug. When you take that sort of stuff and then you start to think about developing an emerging world and access to cancer therapies in those sorts of space, in those sorts of populations, it's just a totally different world, and one that we really, you know, if we think about equity and access to cancer treatment as it becomes a growing problem, particularly in the emerging economy countries, it's something that we're going to have to confront. And I think Richard will give you some interesting insights as to how he has thought about this problem. Thank you, Richard.
Super. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you very much indeed for bringing me over here. It's lovely to be in the heat and the light. And just to say, gentlemen, I'm very available for urological consult later on. So I've suddenly realised that I could substantially improve my salary. So it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you about something we've been agonising about in UK and does this work? Perfect. In the UK and Europe now for quite a while. I'm going to focus quite a lot about medicines, but I'm going to talk about other technologies as well. And I'm going to start by saying this. And by the way, curators in museums get really annoyed when you mock up these sorts of photographs, as I've discovered. The problem here is we have medicine, and medicine is essentially an interface between a human-on-human activity with increasing levels of technology here. And in that sense, you know, the human-to-human being is quite an old aspect of medicine. What's new is the rapidly increasing technologies. And by technologies, I do mean medicines, radiotherapy, imaging. Doesn't matter what you think of in cancer, these are all technologies. And as, of course, this works like that. One of the things we've known for quite a while is this problem in health economics, and it's called the Baumol effect. And basically what the Baumol effect says is, look, this is the problem with healthcare generally. If you take something like a Mozart opera, 100 years ago, it would have cost you $1 to put on that opera because that was the human resource cost. Today, that's $100,000 to put that on. It's still the same opera. You can only play it at the same speed. Well, you can actually increase the speed, but it doesn't sound very good. The point is, you still need the human beings to deliver that care, but the cost of human beings is going up and up and up. But of course, on top of this, technology costs are going up and up and up. So if you think by increasing efficiency and productivity, you're going to somehow decrease healthcare costs, think again. Because in theory, it's just going to keep on going up. So you have to find a way of managing things in a way which delivers good outcomes for the most reasonable price and cost. This is the whole value proposition. And of course, the other issue I think we don't really grapple about enough within cancer and the way that the dialogue and the narrative occurs, I think, all over the world here, is that somehow innovation outcomes are linked. As we get cleverer and cleverer and discover new medicines and new technologies, that's somehow going to dramatically improve outcomes. And every bit of evidence we have studying socio-technical evolution of cancer research, or indeed any research area, indicates actually there's not a linear relationship between scientific progress and outcomes. It's quite stochastic. Lots of things happen before you suddenly get a change in the system. Or indeed, things go backwards for a variety of reasons. And this is a big myth that's propagated, that new stuff will come onto the market and suddenly you'll see dramatic improvements in patient population outcomes. And there's a lot of work that goes on. We've worked on this, a number of others, looking at the emergence of personalized medicine drug development, indeed the whole precision medicine era. And what's fascinating about it is how fast it's appeared. So now it's a truism to say cancer research is the single biggest research endeavor in human history by any measure. Publications, money, whatever you want to look at, it outstrips the moonshot, it outstrips, what's that CERN physics thing, you know, the God particle effort. It is the single biggest research effort in human history. And precision medicine has appeared really fast, literally in about the last 15 to 20 years. And there's a real view, actually, at the moment that it's really outstripping public policy. Our ability to innovate and come up with new ideas completely is ahead of legal, regulatory, economic thinking, government policy, because it's happening so quick. And when you look at the landscape and you try and say, well, okay, where's the domination within the landscape? The answer is it's pretty much in medicines and biomarkers. And when you do the analysis, and we've done pieces of work in lung cancer, but we've also generically looked at this, is about 3/4 of it is around research directed at cancer medicines and companion diagnostics. So there's a real imbalance at the moment in the research portfolio globally. But this gives you an idea of the kind of push that's occurring from the research side. And that's really important when you think downstream about the economics of this, because this is an enormous, enormous global research activity. And indeed, what you're finding is non-traditional countries now moving very rapidly into the area. So whereas the US, Europe, Australasia, the high-income countries are dominated, you're starting to see China in particular moving very rapidly now into this area. So, and India's catching up as well. So over the next 10 to 15 years, you will see other emerging powers moving into this and actually driving the agenda. And this is the thing I think everyone gets really confused around, which is price, cost, value, and affordability. They're all completely different things. They're all interrelated, but they are all different things. But ultimately, you have to have a macroeconomic systems perspective. None of this makes sense within cancer unless you know what's going on. And I'm going to start here, first of all, which is simply outcomes in Europe, okay? This is the EU 28 data from Eurocare 5, and there's worldwide data in survival on Concord 2, and I think Concord 3 is going to come out very soon. But that's 5-year survival up that side, and these are all the site-specific cancers, the major anatomical cancers here. And you'll see here these ranges here with some of these dots. And what they indicate is the best and the worst performing countries across Europe. And remember, Europe goes from very, very high income, Scandinavian, down to the middle income countries. And they are Romania, Bulgaria, the Eastern Baltic states. So you can see, first of all, you know, you're grouping in terms of survival, pancreatic, liver, esophageal, all the way up to the other end where testicular is. But what I want to point out here, and the important thing from a systems perspective, is the difference in outcomes between countries. And let's see which one is this. Is the thing? Look at testicular. 30% difference in outcomes between the best and the worst performing country across Europe. This is one of the most curable cancers on the planet. Even breast, for which there are huge European intergroup studies, has a 20% difference. Now, these are the best estimates, by the way. This is being the most generous to the differences in outcomes here. And then you get down to things like rectal cancer and head and neck, nearly 40% difference in outcomes. This is not an economic problem, as I'm going to show you. This is a structural, political, and cultural problem ingrained in some of the systems across Europe. And that's really important when we start talking about money, because the money thing is, and you can't see this line very well, is this is total healthcare expenditure in the public sector. And there you can see healthcare expenditure per capita, not on cancer, this is just public healthcare expenditure. And here we have the mortality to incidence ratio in cancer, all cancers put together. So the higher that number is, the worse the outcomes are for patients. But you have to do the mortality incidence to get the demographic changes. And you'll see here, these are the Central and Eastern European countries, Romania, Macedonia, Albania, and all the way up to Norway and Switzerland up there. And as you can see, there is, in inverted commas, a linear relationship here for total healthcare expenditure generally into the system. But look at the difference here for the same outcomes between Luxembourg and Italy, Netherlands up there. A lot of this is around willingness to pay here. It's about prices that are set, utilizations, cultural behavior. But the point being here is down here, these systems, it's not about the lack of money going into cancer, it's about poor structure. It's the overall poor funding into total healthcare expenditure. And when you start getting into the macroeconomics of cancer care, what you start seeing is there's enormous variability. I'm about to show you stuff which is extraordinary, really. And more importantly, it's got no relationship to outcomes. In fact, far worse than that. Let me just show you hemato-oncology. We published this a couple of years ago. This is primary care in the grey bars in that first bit here. Then you've got outpatient, A&E, inpatient care and drugs. And this is for all hemato-oncology cases across Europe. And it's controlled, it's for prevalent case, but it's also PPP corrected. So you really are comparing 1 euro with 1 euro. And you can see Lithuania and Cyprus there, all the way through to Ireland, Greece. And look at the expenditures, 38,000 euros per hemonc patient in Greece compared to Lithuania at 5,431. My point I want to make here is it's all over the place. The direct costs of cancer in these countries make no sense whatsoever. You could argue, very plausibly, Ireland, Iceland and Greece, this is a completely runaway system here. The pricing and the utilization, these are absolutely extraordinary figures. And I can go on and show you something completely different. This is the latest data for colorectal. It hasn't been published yet. We're going to publish it later on this year. And here I'm going to just want to focus on pharmaceuticals and hospital care, which is the golden bar and the blue bar there. And at the top here in expenditure, Estonia, Hungary, Lithuania and Romania. Okay? This makes no sense. It literally makes no sense when you start. And these are real figures here, by the way. And the reason is, and you can look at the pharmaceutical costs here. So what you've got is overutilization and high prices being paid. And when you start looking at outcomes here, and I'm just going to show you, I'm going to show you the prostate data. Look at prostate data. This case fatality rate, there's an inverse relationship. So it looks like the more money you spend on your prostate cancer patients, the worse are the outcomes. Why? Because Romania, Hungary, there's Greece up there, Slovakia. You've got a whole load of countries which are complete outliers, which are spending vast amounts of money on cancer, and their outcomes are still dreadful. And the colorectal, look again, look at that. Absolutely inverse relationship in the colorectal as well. And the point I want to make here is that actually when you strip this out,
what you're seeing basically is all these new medicines are just one more technology that are being added into systems with increasing human resources. But many countries in Europe, and I'm pointing at Europe here, have really significant governance failures, both in the public and the private delivery of care, because a lot of these countries have got mixed systems here. But they've essentially had a complete breakdown of their systems of governance for delivering decent care. And what you do is when you dissect this out, and I'm not going to go through all this data to show you this, but what you see is the weaker the power of the country to negotiate, the more fragmented and dynamic the public-private interface is, then the higher the prices and the greater the utilisation, not just of medicines, but across all technologies. And that's why you see this dreadful inverse relationship. But the point is, it's a real warning to other countries that as you put more money into cancer, as you increase your total health expenditure, if you don't find a way of managing that system to deliver good outcomes, you end up in what I call the Romanian-Hungarian trap. Lousy outcomes and spending an absolute fortune. And actually breaking that cycle is a real, real problem. So let's move on to kind of value and affordability, because that's the macroeconomics. And then you're kind of getting into the weeds now. And this is where it starts getting interesting. First thing is this problem of whose value counts. Okay, so we talk about value. And in economics, there's a very strict definition of that. It's about what you put in and the outcomes you get out. But I'm not joking. Actually, if you go and read the policy literature out there, you'll find value is defined in all sorts of ways. In fact, it gets really quite philosophical and metaphysical in some of the definitions that you read out there. I have a view of this. I think it's muddying the water. But let's take something like this. Okay, it's a Michelle Kors handbag. Now, let me tell you, I've tried this experiment. If you wrap up a plastic bag and give that as a Christmas present, which does, frankly, the same thing as this, it does not go down well, okay? Wrap this up for Christmas, oh my word, party time, okay? They're both bags. They both carry stuff around. Apparently, this has enormous value, okay? A plastic bag from Tesco, even though it's quite a sturdy one, I can tell you, does not have value. And the problem is you have real divergent judgments within and between societies. Nearly all of these studies that have been done, there have been some really nice social science studies looking at value, show there's incredible divergence. You know, what is valued within Australia as a group is not what will be valued within the UK, even though we, you know, we have commonalities in culture and, dare I say it, commonalities in language as well. And also, nobody knows anything. One of the problems with value is we do it at this particular time on a retrospective. Often it's very hard to value new technologies because we don't quite know where they're going to go. And I use the example of rituximab. Did anybody have a clue that we were going to have, what, 7, 8 indications for rituximab now and it's used so widely? And this is the problem. It's this ability to be able to foresee how much impact technologies are going to have going forward into the future. So I kind of say to people, look, it's really hard to argue against the fact that we should pay for value. Of course. This is the mantra we're talking about with cancer medicines in the UK, every meeting I go to. Until you start trying to pin down whose value really counts. So who has power and precedence in the value argument about where we define this? And also the thresholds of value when it comes to economics. So value in industry, of course, is defined on ROI. It's return on investment. And I'm going to show you this data again, but there's a whole load of it coming out later this year. So we're finishing this off. We've been looking with UBS and Schroders at the kind of profit margins that companies in the seven major markets are making. And what's fascinating here is, if you're right at the top, of course, it's always been that cardiovascular and hematology generally, non-cancer, has always generated fantastic returns. But what they've started to notice, so we've only got 2012 data, this is starting to come down. And the projections are it's going to come down and down and down. Why? Better prevention, statins, etc., aspirin, and more interventional radiology. So the need for more expensive cardiovascular drugs is simply going to decrease. And indeed, it's flatlining everywhere else. Look at oncology. Look at this. Okay? This is what no one understands, okay? The pharmaceutical industry is about MSV. It's maximizing shareholder value. It is about generating money. It's the capitalist market here. Oncology is the single biggest growth area anywhere. It's generating sensational returns on investment globally. And it's not the pharmaceutical companies we're talking about, it's the shareholders, and the shareholders are the banks, by and large. And this, of course, generates enormous flows of capital moving around the place. So, of course, from the pharma point of view, cancer drugs have enormous value. They have value in monetary terms. So most of the public debate, really, about price at the moment, I really caution this, is driven by the USA. People like Peter Back, a lot of the data that comes out and analyses from the US, and I'm going to show you about that now. But I'm going to say, you've got to watch it with the USA data when we talk about this. And remember, it is a uniquely dysfunctional market. Lovely. Yeah. And you know, and as one D. Trump said, who knew healthcare could be so complicated? Fantastic. He's absolutely brilliant. Love it. Love it. It's the best statement ever. Best. It's also very difficult to compare data. The transparency and systems of health and cancer care are very different in different countries. And that's a problem we have constantly when we're doing an analysis of prices, is we often don't know what the true price is. We get the list price, but we don't know what's happening to rebates, we don't know what's happening with discounting, and you've got to really watch it when you're looking at a lot of this data. But we are starting to unpack some of this about the true value by focusing on the efficacy side. I'm going to tell you about the clinically meaningful benefit stuff that's gaining enormous traction over in Europe and less so in the US, but it's getting there. But let me start by just talking about value in the real world. One of the few places you can do this is the US because of the transparency, because we can collect the data and because of SEER. And this is a nice piece of work that was actually published in Health Affairs by David Howard at Emory. And it looked at the cost of chemotherapy in the real world, metastatic patients in the USA, comparing 1996-2000 cohort with 2007-11. And this is what they found, basically, that with breast cancer, the change over time here, and this is months of survival gained and the cost increase, okay, in thousands of dollars. And essentially what they saw with breast cancer, no therapy, it's gone up to sort of $9,000 cost increase. For a 13-month overall gain in survival in metastatic breast cancer, basically what you're looking at now is $72,000. Okay? That is basically what we're looking at in the USA. Look at chronic myeloid leukemia, CML. 22 months of survival gain at a cost of $142,000. Okay? So this is what I sent about the uniqueness of the American market, but it does start giving you an idea of when you talk about the real world, what you're actually seeing in terms of not just price increases, but this is cost, because these are the regimen costs that are being used to treat the patients. So this is the full Monty from David Howard. It's a really interesting paper. And I'm putting immuno-oncology in here because this is the best estimates we've got at the moment, which is actually, people talk about the immuno-oncology being the great blockbuster. It is for certain patients. But when you put them together as a population and you're looking at something like, and we're looking here at, which one's this one? This is lung cancer. We're only talking about an increase to there. But look at this. We're talking it's going to nearly hit $200,000 for that small increase in the US. Those are the projections from David, who's allowed me to show this today. That is an absolutely seismic increase in the cost compared to the gains. So the question we've been asking ourselves, are we really seeing declining value or just a problem of managing greater uncertainty? And this comes down to this, and I'm not going through it in detail, but this ESMO threshold. We've been focused so much on just accepting the outcomes that we're getting with our cancer medicines. We haven't been asked the question, are we really getting medicines onto the market which are delivering clinically meaningful benefit to our patients? And so, what was it, about 3 or 4 years ago, myself, David, and a chap called Nathan Cherney, we kind of dreamt up this idea of, let's just reassess the drugs that are already out in the market using something which is a clinically meaningful benefit scale for both the palliative and the curative setting. And with European Society for Medical Oncology, with some very progressive colleagues at the time, we developed this new scale, which looked at whether or not drugs were delivering clinically meaningful benefit. Forget the cost here, it's just do they do something for patients. And basically what we've done is we've analysed this and demonstrated that 71% of new medicines to the European Medicines Agency that have got licences for breast, non-small cell lung cancer, GI cancers, fail to reach the thresholds for having clinically meaningful benefit. And this is a benefit scale that was developed with 500 medical oncologists across the whole of Europe, This is not some academic exercise here. 71% of the medicines that have marketing authorizations that are on the market, they were all given marketing authorizations. So what we're basically seeing is more technologies, medicines and other technologies, getting into routine clinical practice with lower and lower levels of uncertainty. And indeed, when you look at something like hemato-oncology, you know, the gain in median overall survival was only found in 55% of the medicines put into the market. And only 16% had a greater survival than 3 months here. Indeed, the last analysis that's just come out, and it's only come out in the last couple of weeks, so I haven't changed the slide yet, which was in the BMJ, showed that in the EMA, 5 years after marketing authorization, only one in four drugs demonstrated significant improvements in quality of life and or survival, yet they're all still on the market. So in my view, we have a significant problem. This is not uncertainty. These are just technologies getting in which do not have clinically meaningful benefit. But it gets worse. I just love cheering everybody up. Cancer Drugs Fund. This was a central subvention fund created by the UK after the government panicked about NICE, and a lot of patients went on TV claiming that the lack of access to drugs which had been deemed not cost-effective by NICE was killing them. And so the British government created this Cancer Drugs Fund. 49 indications it created for 29 drugs over about 5-6 years. We spent over £1 billion on this fund, okay? And it was an absolute unmitigated failure. It was a failure of fairness, understanding value, or anything. And within this paper, but also another paper coming out, what we're going to show is basically that all the money spent and all the drugs used, if you look at the whole population of patients that were treated, actually the outcomes were worse for that patient group. Now that is going to be horrible for a lot of people, and there's a one reason for this, and this is the most important lesson from this paper, is that the major academic centres actually use the fund quite wisely. Very, very sporadically they use it in order to access certain drugs out of that. The majority of the use of this fund was done by district general hospitals though, by medical oncologists and clinical oncologists who did not understand how these medicines really worked and did not have the infrastructure in pathology and imaging to utilize them properly. So they misprescribed them in the first place, and then they mismanaged the side effects in the second place. And of course, misprescribing a lot of these drugs, and you'll understand this with hazard ratios, often you can accelerate the disease of a patient if you give them the wrong sort of therapy. And that's exactly what happened. And unfortunately, majority of patients were treated in district general hospital setting. So there's a real problem here that a lot of the complex new medical therapies coming through, there is a huge divergence between the super centres and where most patients go to in terms of district hospitals. It's a really, really serious warning. But it's also important to consider cost and value in the wider context. And I've given medicines a hard time, and I'm going to give myself a hard time now. I like beating myself, actually. Actually, that sounds wrong, doesn't it? Ignore that. Non-medical technologies are contributing to over 50% of our direct healthcare costs. Look at this. No wonder he's looking tanned and healthy. It's a urologist with a Da Vinci. He probably spends 50% of his time sunning himself in the Caribbean. I'm just jealous, of course. So let's talk about Da Vinci. This is great. I love Da Vinci. So this is a paper that came out. It's out now online. Yes, it's definitely out online. It's the impact of the Da Vinci on urological cancer services in England. It's a really nice piece of work that I did with it. It was led by a colleague of mine, AJ Agarwal, fantastic clinical oncologist, hyper smart, ruined his career doing this, by the way. This is what's happened with robotic centres versus total surgical centres. These total surgical centres for urology have been going down, and look at the uptake of robotic centres. This is an enormous uptake of Da Vinci. And what you basically happened was, in pre-2010, these are the robotic centres, so these are numbers of patients gained or lost by each radical prostatectomy provider. So prior to this, we had a whole load of centres doing nerve-sparing radical prostatectomies. And then along came 2010 and Da Vinci, and all of these centres then took up the robots and gained huge numbers of patients. A lot of centres, these are all individual centres, 65 centres across England, started losing patients like crazy. Now, if the volumes start going down, what do you think happens to that centre? It closes. It's financially unviable. But this is a really important thing. Where do you think the men came from who started accessing da Vinci's in 2010? Do you think they were from deprived backgrounds or affluent backgrounds? Yeah, right. Here's your problem. The people making the choice were not poor men here. They were wealthy OPCS class 1 and 2 who were jumping over centres to access the Da Vinci. And it was all based on a list published in the Daily Mail. The robotics list of a whole load of surgeons advertising the Da Vinci robot. And of course what happens is, this is what happens, all these centres down here start closing because they're losing so many patients. I'm never quite sure what happened there. I've still got to dissect that one out. But the bottom line is, by and large, all these other centres started closing. Actually, a few more have closed since this analysis was done. Everyone panics, okay? The bottom line is, if you don't get a robot, you are in deep trouble here. So the next thing you have, and you have all these surgeons rushing out, and these green bars now are the centres buying robots. So everyone starts buying robots, because that's the only way they're going to hold on to the patients they've got and not lose even more. But here's the crunch. When we did the actual analysis, this is what happened. Of course, outcomes for men from deprived backgrounds went down because they didn't jump over. They lost access to their centre. They weren't willing to travel. And Kelsapris, that meant that their outcomes were worse. It means they were just translating to later stage. And there was no change for affluent men moving. Outcomes did not improve because a lot of the men went to Da Vinci centres that did not have access to good radiotherapy. And you need access to good radiotherapy. So these were not tri-modality centres they were moving to. Cost increase, and so did inequality. What you actually see when you analyse is a cost increase, because Da Vinci is so much more expensive. And it's led us to make the point that there's a really poor understanding in the UK and across Europe of how policies around competition, choice and centralisation interact. Because these are all simultaneously going on, and our government certainly is utterly clueless about how these can contradict and create these perverse incentives, and also how new technologies outside medicine can drive patient movement in a way that seems obvious now, but at the time was not properly studied at all. So, let's go down to... Oh, marvellous. Look at that handsome fellow there. Anyone? Who's this? Yeah, Kissinger. Right there. Power and the public discourse in the policy debate. This is where I get really excited. Hyperbole and propaganda. Cancer care takes a giant step forward. It is hard to get through a day in the UK without getting hit with something about cancer, and particularly about how new technologies or new cancer medicine is going to cure you, and particularly around precision medicine. But this is wonderful. This is a quote by a really famous chap called Andrea Califano. There is a growing realization the next step in precision medicine is to address the actual lack of precision. Brilliant. That may well represent the paradoxical Achilles heel of current precision-based strategies for cancer. This is actually dissected out. You've got to go and look at Medscape. It's a sensational quote. So Andrea Califano is one of the real godfathers of precision cancer medicine here. Basically, our research community is saying, you know what? We have a problem here. I mean, immunotherapy, we're awash with prognostic markers. Have we got any predictive markers? Decent ones? No, zero. Okay? So there's a real discourse. You know, within the research community, we understand this. Out in the general public, there's a complete discourse disconnection here. And I'm going to argue, actually, a lot of the discourse out there at the moment is really, really not honest. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that in a second. It's really highly unbiased. And there's a real medicine-centric with little understanding or debate about the impact of non-medical technologies and really irrational models and pathways of care that are growing across the board. And this is interesting. We've just finished this analysis looking at... We have something called talking heads. So these are patients that go on TV to talk about how remarkable a particular drug was for saving their life. Okay? And they repeat certain facts about how much life they were given and what this drug will actually do. So we've analysed this. We've actually gone and looked over the last 5 years. And this is, trust me, at first it's interesting. By the 15th interview, you're starting to lose the will to live. And by interview 35, you know, you're having to take stimulants and amphetamines to stay awake. Nevertheless, we've done it. We've analysed it. 77% of talking heads, these are patients and organisational representatives from major charities, failed to achieve basic thresholds for truthfulness and accuracy. I'm not saying they're lying. This is a really important caveat. They just repeat something they think is the truth and that's accurate, but it is not. But I'm going to tell you, in no incident, in none of these cases was any of this dialogue or discourse challenged by any expert on the program or indeed subsequently. So that's what's flowing out. Just flows out, day in, day out. Every program you can imagine. And indeed, this has just been accepted by BMJ. We've analysed the reporting of cancer drugs at the Cancer Drugs Fund in the UK media. So this disastrous fund, which loads of people were talking about for years, how awful it was. These are the newspapers, Daily Mail. Do we know the Daily Mail? What every right-thinking British person reads, okay? Telling you how, you know, the average Brit is thinking. The Sun. Telling you what the average roadie is thinking, you know, the average white van man is thinking. And these are hugely powerful papers, okay? The Mirror, okay? I don't know what Dex is. Dexamethasone. No, it's not. So Daily Mail, Sun, The Mirror.
Daily Express.
It's the Express nightmare. Okay, another nightmare paper. Oh, it's awful. And down this other end, you've got Financial Times, The Guardian, The Independent, and I think that's The Standard and The Times here. White means it was neutral. The story was neither here nor there. If it was red, it means the stories, and we've had coded these in different ways. I won't talk you through those. Basically, red means a negative piece of reporting. Anything else in green or shaded green means, wow, what a winner, for all sorts of reasons. Something like, I think it's something like 80-something percent of the population actually reads those four. Okay? So it's no good saying, well, look at The Guardian. There are quite a lot of negative stories. That's quite nicely balanced. The reality is, you know what The Guardian is? It's left-wing, tofu-eating, sandal-wearing. I read The Guardian, by the way. This is unusual for me to wear this. You know, normally I'm hugging a dolphin. Guardian reader. But that's the problem. This is outrageous. This is what the public get faced with. So the public discourse is a real problem. And I just want to take also just a moment to say that within all this and background of all this, and I mentioned it right at the beginning, is the power around pricing. So out there, it's saying what amazing drugs these things are. We should be paying any price that's necessary to get hold of them, okay? But of course, at the back end of it, power around pricing is intrinsic to our respective political economies. We have accepted, from an industry perspective, legal monopoly, patents and systems around maximising shareholder value. We've accepting orphan drug designation, SPCs. We accept those sorts of returns of investment as part of the capitalist system, okay? And market power determines prices. National economic policies determine costs, and development determines affordability. And the question here is about how you put fairness in the heart of the economic models, and it hasn't been a priority. You hardly ever hear the word fair being used. Now, Peter Back was the first one actually to talk about just pricing quite a few years ago in the USA, but it's more than just pricing. Just as a sort of term in philosophy is a difficult one, it's about fairness here. And it's about paying a fair price, and it's about charging a fair price. And we all instinctively know that. And at the moment, it's gone like that. So the last few slides are, what are the solutions? And you can really end up feeling like a Greek chorus. And the problem with the Greek choruses is, when in Greek tragedy, I was forced to do this at school. I really hated this, but anyway, it's proved useful later on as an analogy. In Greek tragedy, you have the main actors on the stage which interact with each other, and then you have a chorus around the stage. Now, those individuals can comment on the action, they can talk to the audience, but they don't influence what's actually going on the main stage at all. And that's what a Greek chorus is. So we can all talk about this, but nothing changes. You know, it's terrific. I mean, I think the first thing is to say there's a question about the pharmaceutical regulation generally. I'm not going to deal with changes in IPR. If you ask me some questions about it, that's fine. I cannot give you my personal opinion. But there is a real problem in the regulatory environment. And my colleagues Courtney Davis and John Abram have done this. There is this mantra of needing to move quicker into the clinic, okay? That somehow people are dying because we're not moving fast enough, okay? It's like faster, faster, faster. There's a push now for literally phase two single arm trials being sufficient evidence to put a drug into market. It's insane. It's completely insane. And I think there's not just growing empirical evidence. I think there really is the evidence now to say this is actually reducing value and counter to the public good. So, but how on earth do you change a regulatory paradigm which is set by the FDA and is aped by everybody else? and particularly the European Medicines Agency, which holds enormous sway through Australia, etc. And that's an incredibly difficult one. I think changing the choice architectures was a really major challenge. You know, the high-income mantra is one of choice now, is personalisation. We very rarely talk about societal values and about collective responsibility anymore. It's about the individual choice, and it's about precision for that individual. You know, nudge policies have yet to demonstrate, I think, meaningful impact. I really like them. I mean, Richard Thaler got the Nobel Prize this time, and I think there's some really interesting examples of where it's worked. The question is really the nudge way? Because a lot of people talk about using nudge, or is this about having just have a stronger regulatory approval? There is a big problem with our clinical trials. We are not mandating clinical trials aiming for significant clinically meaningful benefit at the moment, and that's a failure of the pharmaceutical industry. It's also a failure of our philanthropic funders. If you look at who's behind a lot of these are clinical investigators, research funding organisations, federally or philanthropically funded, and they're not holding the trials to account. And we're also not really building up enough socioeconomic components. You know, it just isn't. A lot of trials, we do the socioeconomic bit retrospectively rather than prospectively. I'm going to say that I think pricing and overall cost of cancer medicines and other technologies really has to be brought under strict governance, which is fair for all parties. There's a lot of discussion in Europe at the moment about price discrimination, requiring a lack of transparency, and there's arguments both for and against that. Meaningful benefit scales. I think this is one of the things that's really starting to change the dialogue in Europe. Is when you show this scale, which has obviously been developed by medical oncologists for medical oncologists, it's hard to argue with the data. You know, the one in four is, it's pretty disgraceful. And people can't argue against that. And that's really changed the narrative quite a lot. And I kind of, you know, this is the question we're asking, is whether they need an intermediate step, or we just simply raise the regulatory barrier in some way. Weirdly, I think medicines are much easier to deal with. It's a hell of a job to put in a proton beam therapy machine and then 10 years from now turn up with a bulldozer and say, look, sorry everybody, it's not cost effective, and dig it up. So there's a lot of problems within surgical and non-medical technologies is once these things are embedded, once they're paid for and put in a clinic or put in a hospital, you're stuck with them and you have to make a reverse business case on them. You can't just turn up and try and take a Da Vinci off a surgeon. Feel free to try that, really. They'll beat you to death, you know, to try and get you to hang on to it. And these are sunk costs in situations. And I kind of guess with all this, the market isn't self-correcting. At the moment, we're not getting enough value, in my view, from all the cancer technologies. But we don't have buy-in from the professional community. Patient organisations will scream access without talking about fair pricing. And we have real battles over that. And even the research funders now stay very, very quiet. A lot of our research funders in Europe have kind of moved quietly to underpin pharmaceutical research without keeping the broad Catholic view and without actually acting as counterweights to what's going on in private sector drug development. And I, you know, I'd love to see this as being a kind of bottom up. And I think in some places and with some communities, we can achieve some bottom up. But to be blunt with you, I think a lot of this is going to require some really... Well, it's going to require a lot better value, and this is going to require some major changes to our systems. And a lot of these will be really big levers to do with economics and mandatory changes to the way we do certain clinical trials and the way we regulate things. Because I can't see in the immediate term how we can wait for the system to be self-organising and to the point where we get better value coming out. So there we are. I'm going to leave you with a bit of Leviathan, which seems right, doesn't it, coming from the UK, Hobbes. Thank you very much indeed.
We have a few minutes for some questions. Please, thank you so much for the presentation. My name is Narcissus and I'm from Sydney Health Ethics. I've been working in this area for quite some time.
Well, quite some time, about 3 or 4 years now, and I just have some additional points to make on top of some of your points. You mentioned rhetoric in the media, but there's also research which shows a lot of this rhetoric begins in the universities with the researchers trying to promote their research, which gets published in press releases, and those press releases get picked up by the media. So there's this spin which begins with the researchers themselves who want to get research funding in the future. So that's a major problem.
Yeah. Great.
I've also spoken to a number of oncologists as part of my research, and one of them mentioned that they have to be seen to be advocates for the patient, even though they're happy with the decisions which, say, the government makes regarding funding. But you mentioned that physicians don't come out and counter the rhetoric, and I think that's part of the reason they can't be seen to be going right against their patients. You also mentioned about a lot of the NHS, the cancer drug, the drugs approved by the UK Cancer Drug Fund being utilised by people who don't know how to use them properly. Mm. And another thing which came up in some of the research I've done is that physicians find it very hard to say no when the patient knows it's available and knows it's funded and is demanding it. So that's another challenge for physicians. And finally,
give other people tags for a question.
Sorry,
I totally agree. You're spot on with all of those. Yeah, I completely. Yeah.
That was a fantastic talk. Thank you. I'm just curious what's happening in Europe and the UK. Is it really possible that EMA could withdraw the fast track breakthrough designation and be stricter? But also, what's happening in NICE now? The Cancer Drugs Fund has been, I think, reimagined. What's your hope, or what's actually happening to address your concerns?
Yeah, so that was the good news on that is the CDF has been rolled into NICE, so it's used as an interim fund now for technology which is still going through appraisal. So that sounds a more logical. NICE is struggling, obviously, with multi-criteria decision analysis and the evolving models, particularly around immuno-oncology. I mean, we've added in quietly a new criteria which hasn't been used yet, which is affordability, because something can be cost-effective and unaffordable. And indeed, we're also reaching what we call the zero-price problem, which is a new drug can come in, and even if it was priced at zero, it's still not cost-effective because it gets layered onto a regimen because, which are already at. Because remember, our thresholds are not value discriminators. You, as a company, you either overprice it and break the threshold and get rejected, or you come just underneath the threshold, irrespective of the clinically meaningful benefit. So NICE at the moment is still held up with the gold standard. I mean, that's where all the heat and light is, and there's some very interesting HTA assessment going on by the Commission at the moment to see if there's some coherence in Europe, and the preliminary results are out. It's an absolute mess. I have never seen so many divergent opinions from different countries and different bodies about what the future should be for HTA Europe. So from that perspective, I don't know where it's going to go. From the regulatory, I can tell you the EMA, I mean, we've been called three times now to explain to them the clinically meaningful benefit. There are CHMPs, so that's the General Committee, and there's the Orphans Medicines Committee, are very interested in this because they're feeling real heat at the moment about this. But what controls them are the politics and industry, not civil society, I'm afraid.
I love the comment that the EMA was going to move from London to North France so that people could just commute across the channel without having to move their houses.
I know. It's just it's very thoughtful, isn't it?
Alyssa Smith, thank you for your talks. Really interesting. I have a question about other variables that might be influencing the efficacy of drugs. So how do you account for things like dialysis or people taking complementary therapies that you may or may not know about? I mean, how do you account for variables like that when you're doing this type of work?
In the sense of, you mean the cost analysis? Or
cost and outcome, I guess more around outcome versus cost. So how do you know, because you're looking at value, right? And so how do you account for, you may see poor outcomes, but it may not be specific to the drug. It might be another factor that's influencing.
You mean
that
another
outcome?
Confounding variable within that?
That's
no,
right. We've,
so the great thing about the CDF is, despite the fact it wasn't collected together, they collected agonizing patient pathway data as part of the requirements for that, but that was all kept at the hospital level. It's why it's taken so long to do this. We've had to go to each hospital and get those pathways, and you're absolutely right. You've had to be very careful to see if there's anything else causing the poor outcomes here, or whether it was generally due to the, you know, the therapy occurring. So we've been very careful to do this. And that's the worry. And actually, some of this, when we've shown it to clinicians, they've all shrugged their shoulders and said, yeah, we're not surprised. We've seen this in loads of patients, acceleration of disease, if you use an mTOR inhibitor in these situations. And believe me, there are some really bizarre. So
you know, the, I'm trying to think of, you know, mTOR inhibitors, use of ROS1 inhibitors when there's no ROS1 expression, use of ALK inhibitors with a zero ALK expression. I mean, some really bizarre stuff that's been used. And we almost want to find those clinicians now and do a qualitative study which says why. Because it comes out to the gentleman's question. Was it the pressure of the patient? Were you being dumb? What was the reason this was going on? You know, you can expect it one or two times, but not on the level we saw. You know, and particularly they were also treating patients for which they hadn't done the molecular pathology in many cases. With drugs that absolutely have to have the molecular pathology done in order to know whether or not it's the right indication. So, you know, it may be pressure of patients. It may be that, oh, it's there, I want to do something for you. You know, and it's often not one side or the other. It's a collective dyadic response in that area. And you've got to watch it with this, because what we're trying to do is not blame people. We're trying to say, look, there's a systems problem here, a bit like airline pilots. You know, we can't do this. We've got to control it. You know, clearly, if the drugs are just allowed into the system like that, then these are the outcomes you expect. Because it's very hard. Once you start pointing fingers at people, everyone gets ruthlessly defensive. So it's going to be quite sensitive when this comes out about how we do it. What worries me is how the media reports it. They don't like a nice, sensitive, balanced story.
Fake news.
Fake news, yes.
Yeah, hi, George Margiela. So my background, I've been involved in medical technology for quite a while now, and you know, most cancer technologies and other technologies, imaging and genomics, all have economic models often generated by marketing departments used as an adjunct to promotion. Yesterday, we had the Productivity Commission in Australia produce an economic model for how we're going to save $200 billion in healthcare by just making GPs talk to hospitals. Can you give us your idea about, yeah, what is the value of economic modelling in healthcare policy, or is it just sort of keeping consultants busy?
Modelling is a bit of a dark art. I think the modelling, good modellers are honest about what assumptions they're making with you. And I think I kind of say to people, look, you need two sides. You need really fabulous modelers who can communicate. And that's almost, you know, that's almost a contradiction in terms. A lot of modelers, I'm sorry, modelers out there, okay, your communication is a bit dicey, who say to you, look, we're assuming X, Y, and Z. Are these assumptions correct? And then there is the input side of things. And the input can become the fuzzy logic, which is the human beings, and the real data. And we're not very good at triangulating these things. So modeling is very important, but you have to be very clear what assumptions you're doing and how far out. It's a sensitive dependent on initial conditions problem that physics came up many years ago. Is the further out in time you get, the more uncertainty there is, to the point where you're just going, it's tossing a coin here, you know? And that's how we treat modeling. But it requires people going off and learning about modeling and economics, and people don't. You know, particularly my consultant colleagues who think they know it. It's like, yeah, I'm a consultant, I know everything.
Stuart Roger, I'm a health actuary. Firstly, on the modelling, one of the really interesting underlying structures to your talk is the implication that there are relationships between the economics and the clinical outcomes and the national wealth. And if your thesis is that there are relationships, it does actually cry out for the model that reflects those relationships. Not what I wanted to say. The affordability, you mentioned affordability up here as one of four things very different, only came up as a response to the question back here. But it does seem to me the paradigm in the industry we're talking about is that if we find something good, it'll be paid for. And that is a problem, because in throughout industry and government and universities, there are so many more good ideas than you have money for. I'd be interested in more about how affordability can be factored in as a limiting factor. For example, only drugs that are below a certain cost, or an acceptance that everybody gets things up to this level of cost, and after that, it's just if you're lucky enough to have the money. That's okay, so can you comment on that?
Yeah, thank you. I was hoping nobody would ask me that. Because that is the problem. This is the, you know, we're good up to the cost effectiveness bit. We're good at the budgeting. And then you have this fuzzy zone you get into, which is the affordability discussion. And if you do it from the other end, which is around, you know, the wealth of a country, the GDP, GMP, all the other, and you go that way, you can start working out, and Peter Smith at the UK Imperial has done a lot of this, which is he reversed engineered the wealth of the UK and GDP and asked the question, what threshold should NICE have for the qualies? You know, and this comes down to this business, as you and I know, value of a statistical life in a particular economy. But more importantly, he never really included that in his models. It was much more the affordability. And the thresholds, when you look at our thresholds, they're about right for the wealth of the UK. So we have these thresholds of how much we're willing to pay for an individual quality-adjusted life year. And remember, this was something developed in the quality was developed by Harvard University in the 1990s as a way of prioritization. It was never actually designed for this. So you do it that way around, and you come up with a quality, and you say, okay, that's fine, that's the cost-effectiveness. The problem with affordability is affordability within what area? Is this the healthcare budget for your hospital? Affordable for the whole system as a whole? And this is the arguments we end up talking about, because it might look affordable for the whole of a UK, a particular cost-effective technology, but for a hospital, under a limited budget, it's not affordable. So we get into these dreadful arguments about this, because it comes down to also looking at the slices of the pie that each individual area is. And then you're onto the cusp of the affordability versus fairness. But I think we're ending some very subjective territory here. And when we sit around tables talking about this, what you've hit the nail on the head here is we move from objective to subjective very quickly.
It's a change in social compact.
Right.
And until we take control of that,
right.
I think we're actually drifting into a social result where money is the only thing that matters.
Right. Affordability, you know, people will say, well, okay, it's unaffordable, but we want it, therefore what budget are we going to cut to make it affordable? And this becomes a big, as you say, trade-off arguments within individual countries or hospitals about where they put their priorities. It comes back to priorities again.
Yeah. And expectations.
And expectations.
Right.
Right.
But
once upon a time, this was done and no one knew what was going on, if you know what I mean. Now we've got information passing. You suddenly go, hang on a minute, how come they've got access to that and we haven't? So you get this dreadful Kenneth Arrow business, which he said wars happen, which is information asymmetry everywhere.
Please. Hello, my name's Bernadette, and I work for the Cancer Council here in this state in an advocacy team. Mm. I just want to go home and crawl under the doona just now, but I wondered whether you wanted to finish on a positive note about what bottom-up advocacy might look like in this area.
So I think it came down to the honest discourse about stuff. I don't think, and we've only started doing this now, sitting down with patient organisations and advocacy groups and going through all this data with them, because whilst this might be bread and butter for all of us in here and we understand this and we understand the nuances of the difference between progression-free survival and overall survival, surrogate endpoints and stuff like that. I think this is really, certainly patient advocates I've talked and we work with quite a lot at King's, we realise there's a massive education and understanding gap between what's happening in the cutting edge of research and public policy and what they're being exposed to within the advocacy groups. And we've kind of, you know, it's very easy to criticise advocacy groups, but if they don't know, if you haven't had this explained to you, of why there's this problem here and why the argument's here or why it's finally balanced or the differences between cost-effective and affordable, it's very then difficult to come to the table and have a reasonable discussion and argument about it. So the plan we've got in the UK is to set up all these, they're basically education sessions to get people to be able to critically understand what's happening and what the trade-offs are when you're arguing for greater access to medicines or greater access to PBT. What's the other side? And it's about, for me, it's about empowerment. It's not telling people how to think. It's trying to empower them with the tools so that they can actually make those reasoned discussions when things come out or when the media rings them up. Or you do see what I'm getting at? And I don't know, some people will violently disagree with me and say that's not the job of the professional communities to do this because it kind of muddies the water. But I think it is. Because I think we're on completely different pages at the moment.
Oh, thanks, Richard, for your talk. I'm Stephen Jan, health economist at the George Institute. And I think the underlying problem that you sort of discussing here is the one of governance, which you raised early on, and the fact that in the system that you're talking about, it's not like a market. You have basically everybody, all the players, pushing in one direction, and there's no countervailing pressure on keeping costs down. So there's really, and it's a bit discouraging because I've always thought of the UK and NICE as a system where that sort of thing is in place, and it's probably seen as an exemplar for containment of costs. And we have a similar system in Australia. So given that context and the problems you've highlighted, are there examples worldwide where you can sort of say, well, they've got the answers, or they're moving towards a promising solution?
I think this is about entropy. I think the problem is we've always thought there is this kind of quite Marxist thing. There's this golden thing out there that we're all trying. This is about putting energy in. The problem with the system is you have to put energy in to keep it at the right level, And if you just sort of leave it alone, it will drop off one side or the other here. And I think the UK will argue, and France, I've talked, I was out with the French and the Germans recently, talking about IQIC from the Germans, who shrugged their shoulders and said, we don't have a problem. We don't have a problem. We do our thing, we don't care. My German accent's a very good accent. I have to do a very good job. Because we believe we're a strong country. We make mistakes, like the CDF, but we sort it out, and then we sort of merge it back in, and yes, we wasted £1 billion. I know.
1 billion?
Only 1 billion, who cares? So this is the question about all our systems intrinsically have strengths and faults to them. And each of our systems in terms of the governance arrangements, I don't think you can't say we've got to reach X. We've got to constantly keep evolving things, new governance mechanisms, new ways of looking at cost effectiveness, new ways of making societal decisions around what isn't affordable. And I think we make a dreadful mistake is we still look at the NHS as though this is kind of a closed system when lots of other people are doing the same thing all over the world. And we're not very good at learning from other people's mistakes and strengths and bringing those learnings back to our individual ways of thinking. And I think whether it's, we're looking at, NICE has been particularly good because I think it's reached out, but that's purely in the economic modelling side and dealing with the uncertainty because they've been forced to do that. I think the wider issue, for instance, of patient organ advocacy groups, have we sat down with, Australians, the Germans, and had this honest discussion openly around this? No, we haven't. We've just not done it for a variety of reasons. So I think each country has those strengths and weaknesses, and I think, but the idea that we can get somewhere and then just relax and stop doing anything, because the system by itself has its own momentum, and you've got to constantly not fight against it, manage it.
Richard, one of the issues that's very topical and hot topic in Australia at the moment is the issue of rare cancers and the issues of, if you like, a different type of equity within the cancer community between areas such as breast cancer, some of the hematological cancers, where we've seen massive improvements in terms of responses to therapy and whatever, where the marginal gains now are relatively small for very high costs.
Right.
Whereas we have these other cancer areas where the trials either haven't been done or where the investment in the research is not happening. Do you have a view about that sort of equity and equalisation?
I do. It's interesting, we've just had a discussion with the European Hematology Association. First and foremost, we even get into funding. There's a question of the researchability of an area. People talk about hematology, why we've been so good at getting changes there, and why it really is a very precision field now. The reason, there'll be lots of clinicians out there, in solid cancers, how many biopsies can we actually take? And whether those biopsies really reflect what we're looking at. Whereas in hematology, the ability to kind of continually biopsy, continually watch the system is there. So there's a much higher researchability that exists. And often when you're talking about rare cancers, which are rare solid cancers, the situation's even worse. You're lucky if you get one small biopsy. The idea you're going to be able to get serial biopsies, so you've got a numbers problem within a numbers problem. And we talk about, well, we just need to put more money into it at this end. And you say to people, you can put, 100 million in. It's not going to cure the problem of you can get one biopsy and you'll be lucky if you get 50 patients here. And then it's assuming that you've got the right researchers and the right research questions wrapped around that problem. So there's a lot of assumptions. This is a research systems problem, not you know, a funding problem, or we need to get a marketing authorization problem. So the paediatricians I talk to, you know, I'll give you a classic example of, you know, paediatrics accessing off-label drugs to try them in, you know, in a sort of random and empirical way. That's a classic way of trialing things. So the paediatric community, I think, has some very nice models for taking ad hoc technologies to look at things. But in the adult world, for me, it's the researchability.
Yeah, I'm Satira Pereira, health economist. One question about willingness to pay as a criteria of judging affordability. I personally feel that you stick to willingness to pay and people try to meet up the cost effectiveness according to that particular threshold. So then goes all the manipulations with regard to data and trying to prove that your product is cost effective. So I think, as you correctly mentioned, multi-criteria decision analysis and also considering the budget impact is helpful in that. But don't you think that we really have to think about revising our use of willingness to pay as a sole criteria, and also whether there can be any other thresholds with regard to effectiveness per se, and maybe minimum percentage effectiveness?
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question, and I think you're spot on, because that's the problem with the zero price thing, isn't it? We've got a lot, and it comes back to this problem of we're having drugs being put through to NICE, who buttress right up to the willingness to pay threshold that actually have not got clinically meaningful benefit. But because of the pricing structure, because they know how to make sure it sits there, it gets into the system. Now, you know, this is what I meant about left-shifting things. You can plausibly argue a lot of these medicines should not have been given a regulatory, or they should not have had a marketing authorization. They shouldn't have even got into the HTA system. And as you can imagine, this is what the ESMO scale is about. This is why there's been such a bun fight over it. Because there's NICE and a few others, IQWiC, this is the meeting we were having, are trying to make this decision whether or not they will start using the scale for saying, we're not even going to look at this. If you fall into the 1, 2, or 3 category, don't bother coming to us, because we will not do an HTA on you to deal with exactly this problem, because they've got too many coming in. Now, on the other side, we've kind of, clinicians have rationally said, well, we kind of know if it's not a clinically meaningful benefit, and we just don't use it. So I'll give you an example. Avastin and bevacizumab for breast cancer is still licensed in EMA. Okay, unbelievable. It's still got a marketing authorization. And most of our clinicians said, we'll never use it. However, if you look at sales of Avastin and look at the breast cancer line, it's like this in all these countries. So I'm talking to you like we're having a rational discussion, because the system's operating in a rational way. And you've got to remember, the system in many places is not operating rationally, which I think as economists, you'll understand irrationality, and you deal with this all the time. Yes. Very good question.
Okay,
thank you.
We might just call it quits there. So thank you very much, Richard. It's been extremely fascinating, and we've covered a whole range of topics, which many of the things that you said are not actually confined to cancer, but as you say, the problem is the market at the moment is being driven not just in the chemotherapy area, but in across the medical world by medical technology world by cancer in many ways. So fascinating insight. Thank you very much for your presentation.
My pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.